You're listening to the Bitcoin.com podcast. Our guest today is Brandon Ramirez, co-founder of The Graph. This episode is brought to you by the Bitcoin.com exchange, the exchange you can trust. Buy and sell Bitcoin as well as 250 digital assets. The Bitcoin.com exchange is secure, fast, easy, and reliable. Register within seconds and buy crypto with a credit or debit card. Join our community of traders now. Exchange.bitcoin.com. I'm your host, Dustin Plantholt. Join us as we dive into the world of economics, politics, tech, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrency. For even more crypto-related news, sign up at news.bitcoin.com or follow us on Twitter at Bitcoin.com. Now let's bring on our guest. Brandon Ramirez, welcome to the Bitcoin.com podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dustin.
Now, Brandon, how did you get into cryptocurrency?
Wow. So that takes me actually way back to my first startup in Austin, where I was actually sharing a startup house with some guys that were moving to the Bay to start one of the first Bitcoin exchanges. This was back in like 2013. And at the time, I think the whole narrative was around, you know, decentralized, currency, censorship resistance. I think the community was a lot more, you know, libertarian leaning. And I was really interested in it, but it didn't attract me as a builder. And then I think kind of when 2017 hit and you saw Ethereum, and you saw this kind of new primitive for neutral computing, and people actually started building applications on it besides money. That's when I became really interested in it. So my co-founders at the time, we stopped what we were doing and we basically pivoted into doing a boutique software development agency just to kind of get our feet wet in the space. We started building with different projects. 2017, as you know, people were raising a lot of money. A lot of those teams didn't have a lot of technical talent. So we kind of came in to actually help, you know, supplement those teams. And it was kind of that experience that gave us the confidence and the insight to start The Graph.
Now, this was such a new space at the time. I mean, how did you learn how to develop in a space that hadn't been around for 10, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think obviously people coming into this space, you pivot from whatever your prior experience was. So, you know, a lot of people come into the space from, the Wall Street, you know, crowd, and they're bringing in their deep background in like financial math and so forth. For us, our expertise was building applications. And even though it kind of seems like, you know, Ethereum and decentralized apps were a quantum leap in the way applications are being built, many of the underlying trends in how the craft of, you know, building applications was done were actually in the works for quite some time. So prior to, you know, starting The Graph, we were actually developing a lot of these best practices and building on these best practices. And many of those are what actually influenced, you know, the design of The Graph once we saw that we had this new primitive available.
You know, I always think it's fascinating, the development aspect. You know, people like me, where we don't really know the process. We just know that there's this button on the Google Store or the Apple Store. You can just click a box and then put this specialized application on your phone that it seems like sorcery, but it begins first with someone like you that says, we have an idea. So talk us through that process.
Yeah, so great question. So actually, let me clarify that. Do you want the process from the standpoint of an engineer and entrepreneur?
Absolutely.
Do you want our process in targeting that audience?
That's a great. I want you to talk about both, because this is a show about education. You know, people around the world want to know the process. What does it take? All right, you have this idea in your head. You want to develop a dApp, or you want to get in and create something. And then also, how do you take it to market? How do you build a community around it?
Sure. Yeah. So let's take a step back to how this maybe happened before dApps. So you get this, you know, idea for a business. You do the whole kind of, at this point, cliche lean startup customer development, you know, flow. You assess whether it's, you know, the problem is legitimate. Then you assess whether users will actually use a product to solve that problem. Then you identify the sales channel. So this is, you know, I'm not saying anything new here. This is kind of the standard playbook for startups. And then as a software entrepreneur, you know, you're looking to build the minimum viable thing to validate your assumptions around the product that you're trying to build. Traditionally, the bar for this has been pretty high. I mean, if you look at the history of software development going back, you know, 20, 30 years, like you would have to get your own server rack. You would have to, you know, do both hardware and software and networking. And over that period, what we've done is we've made it more and more efficient to get started. So, you know, when the early 2000s, we had kind of the advent of cloud computing. You had platforms like Amazon come along, where you had, you know, AWS and infrastructure as a service. You had platform as a service. Eventually, in the last few years, we've seen the rise of what are called Lambdas, which are functions as a service. So these very tiny units of functionality that you can just get going with very quickly and just deploy and scale, you know, elastically. This is all happening before the advent of decentralized applications. What decentralized applications changed is now, instead of just leveraging, you know, kind of cloud infrastructure run by a centralized business, or maybe leveraging open source libraries where, you know, you're kind of picking and choosing from these things that people already built, you're actually building on top of open source infrastructure. So you're actually building on top of protocols and applications that already exist in the wild. And so now your time to developing a new idea is actually way shorter than it's ever been, because you can pick and choose from these Lego bricks, you know, it's a term that's used in DeFi a lot, and compose these things into your application. So this was kind of our thesis of like where things were going when we were developing the graph. And you can kind of see it when you look at like our product. So if you go to thegraph.com/explorer, you can actually see what looks kind of like an app store like experience, except it's not an app store for end users. It's actually an app store for developers. And it's really like a sort of smorgasbord of things you can pick and choose from to develop something very quickly without having to start from scratch.
So now, what did it take though to get here? I mean, I have to imagine developing this. This wasn't a, all right, we have an idea, we'll get it done in a day or in 2 days. I mean, how many hours does it take of commitment? You know, many times people want it today, right? You know, we live in a world where it's the immediate gratification that someone goes to the gym and they're going, I can't see results, yet it takes time. So how much time does it take once you've committed and now where you are today?
Well, you're never done, right? So when you say how much time does it take, more time than we've spent already, but it's all about these intermediate milestones that you define, you know, along that journey. And each step of the way, you're looking to kind of validate an increasingly larger and more ambitious set of assumptions. You know, so for us, we're, you know, 3 years into this thing. And our kind of philosophy from the beginning has been, at every point in time, how can we solve the most important problem for, you know, end users in our ecosystem? So when we built the graph, the very first thing that we built was actually just an open source library, and we just gave it away for free. We brought it to hackathons and we tried to get developers to work on it. And at the time, when developers were building on blockchains like Ethereum, one of the biggest challenges they had to overcome was indexing the data that's on the blockchain. And when I say indexing, what I mean is you can kind of think of like a phone book, right? If the names in a phone book were just inserted in any random order, it'd be really hard to find a name. But because they're sorted by last name, you can efficiently access the data you're looking for, you know, in this case, you know, the name of the person. But that's kind of what's happening behind the scenes with databases for most modern applications. But blockchains aren't your typical database. They're much lower level. So we were seeing development teams spend 6 months plus building a custom in-house solution to index the blockchain. And it's not even just, you know, you're not just listening to the blockchain and data processing. Like, as you know, blockchains are weird spaces where you can have things like block reorgs, you know, unplanned, you know, consensus failures. So all these things that the indexing solution would need to kind of keep up with. And every single team was having to redo this work for themselves. After the graph came along, the open source library that we released, you were seeing teams get up and running with this stuff in a weekend. Like, people were actually building full dApps in weekend hackathons, which before, you know, wasn't even possible.
That's remarkable. Now, talk to us like about a hackathon. You know, I've seen this term out there, but what is this?
Yeah, so there, I highly recommend visiting one if you haven't been to one. I don't think the ones in crypto are maybe typical for the space. You know, I think the first one that we launched at, Mike's falling over here. The first one we launched at was at ETH Berlin. It's one of the ETH global events. It was, I think, 2018. And, you know, that one, you know, there's live music, there's DJs, there's like a giant ball pit for some reason. There's coders just kind of occupying this like industrial warehousey type space in a sort of ETH Berlin. And, and people are just coding through the night. People are meeting other builders in the space. For us, it's been this incredible, chance to meet our community and meet our target user, because, you know, the first time we went there, like, our open source library, if I'm being frank, was, you know, pretty rough around the edges. It was pretty buggy. And what we did is we were up there staying up all night with the hackers. If they found a bug in it, you know, our engineering team was fixing it in real time. And some of those first hackers that we met at ETH Berlin way back when continue to be the you know, strongest and most vocal members of our community.
And these are good hackers, right? These aren't like the bad hackers that are out to get your organization.
Correct. Yeah, these are developers, you know, trying to build something that looks, that shows the promise of an idea within a weekend. You know, these things aren't polished, they're not polished applications, but they're things that you can kind of pitch to a panel of judges. And a lot of times these ideas, they get funded and they, you know, continue for many, many years and become full-fledged companies.
So who's your target audience? I mean, who's the ideal customer for the graph?
Yeah, so our view of this has changed over time, right? So when we started, our big target audience was Web3, right? The decentralized web. And that kind of continues to be our driving North Star. That's kind of where our compass needle's headed. But we didn't know yet what would be the first niche, what would be the first set of, you know, developers to kind of find traction within that space. And so we were actually kind of caught off guard when DeFi became the first wave of that. But we do see that as the first wave of, you know, what's going to be this longer transformation in the way that we build all applications. But right now, I would say our target developers have been independent developers, startups, entrepreneurs that are building in the DeFi space.
It seems to be a ever-evolving ecosystem, that there's always some new player entering. What's that been like for you?
It makes me feel old. It makes me feel like a lot of time has passed in a very short amount of time. You're always kind of rolling with the punches. You're always kind of adapting. You know, I think operating in the blockchain space requires a lot of humility, because you know that you're not going to be able to keep up with everything that's going on. You kind of have to pick and choose where you spend your time, try and find as much signal in the noise. You know, for us, what humility looked like was just acknowledging that even though we have this vision for what we eventually want Web3 to become, that, like, right now, DeFi is the place where that's happening, and to work with, you know, meet people where they're at and kind of help nurture and develop the space as much as possible and grow it, you know, into the next wave.
You know, Brandon, I consider you to be, in many ways, the expert's expert, yet you still go out to look for guidance and look for somebody that maybe has a different strength or skill set. So who do you look to in this space for help?
Oh, that's a great question. So, I mean, it varies a lot based on the topic. You know, so my title at the company is research lead and co-founder. So I obviously have a lot of people that I rely on in the research space that I, you know, admire and respect. You know, it's kind of cliche to say, you know, Vitalik, but I do admire his thinking a lot. We've been working with some great external researchers like Block Science, who've been doing really interesting work applying, you know, tools and techniques from, like, control systems engineering into blockchain, protocol design. And that's actually my background many moons ago, was electrical engineering and control systems. So that kind of resonated with me. But there's many dimensions to this, you know. So when we talk about building community, a lot of times we look to maybe some of our investors, when we look to or to other projects in the space that have done that well. When we look to protocol design, we look for comps. You know, what are protocols that have shipped something similar to us? You know, so I was looking at LivePeer, for example, a lot in the early days. It really just depends on the problem set.
Now, investors, I mean, that's always a challenge for a young company, is getting somebody to believe in them. And I am of the belief that passion and enthusiasm, when it sits on your shoulder, it becomes contagious. Yet you're dealing with some of the smartest people in the world. And while they love passion, they also want to be able to see vision. So talk us through, when you met with your first group of investors, what was that like for you?
Yeah, so I've done startups before, and one of my criteria for doing this startup was that I wouldn't do it without getting the buy-in from investors pretty early on. We kind of saw that as our, the first milestone, the first gate to kind of overcome, that if we couldn't sell them, we wouldn't be able to sell other people. And we also knew that this is going to be a long transition. And so we, you know, this was going to be a place where having access to capital was important. Like, you weren't going to bootstrap your way through a 5-year transition period or 10-year transition period. And so part of actually what, you know, really gave us the green light to go ahead, you know, full steam with this idea was that the sell to investors was actually so much easier compared to past ideas that we've, you know, that we've pitched. And in part of that was because this problem that we had stumbled upon was so salient. And because we were so early to it, you know, as, you know, kind of some of the first wave of developers trying to build on top of Ethereum, you know, it was sort of, we had this first mover advantage. No one was doing anything else, you know, even similar in the space at the time. And I think some of our investors kind of saw the graph as sort of a leveraged bet on, you know, Web3 and decentralization in general, right? Like, you could invest in Ethereum, you know, in late 2017 or early 2018, which was, you know, at the time, you know, had already gone through this kind of meteoric rise and then was, you know, sort of cooling off. Or you could invest in, you know, a startup that would potentially be a new protocol that's just as critical for building decentralized applications, but that no one knows about yet. And so I think investors saw the upside in that opportunity.
So now, from a revenue generation, so how would your organization, how will you guys make money?
So the Graph's protocol model is what's called a work token model. So it's a type of utility token where the service providers in the network stake a token to access the protocol. So the way that the Graph makes indexing and querying available to these decentralized applications is actually through a marketplace. And in that marketplace, any service provider can earn, you know, indexing rewards and query fees. And so you can kind of think of, you know, it's not a perfect analogy, but the way that like taxi cab medallions in New York City accrued value because taxi cabs could access the valuable, you know, New York taxi market. You're seeing many protocols adopt something similar. A lot of proof of stake protocols are essentially the same, although it's not a market, you know, in the traditional sense. But it's the requirement to stake the token that drives value.
So what is the difference between proof of stake and proof of work?
So the simplest answer to that is they're both ways to vote on a ordering of transactions. You know, proof of work uses one CPU, one vote. You know, you solve a computational problem to vote on what the next block is going to be in the blockchain. And proof of stake, you're using capital. You're using tokens to vote on what's going to be the next block in the blockchain. That's a very simplified explanation. There's a lot of different ways of, you know,
I like simplification, by the way. I am not of your intellect, but tell us then, what is a block? Because that terminology is used quite frequently. What is a block?
Yeah, so you're actually seeing the definition of this change quite a bit, which is interesting. But a block in its simplest form is just a grouping of transactions, right? So in, you know, Bitcoin, you have a group of transactions that are just transferring Bitcoin to one another. In Ethereum, you have a little bit more, right? You have some transactions, and then you have like application state that's changing. Blocks even have events that are emitted in Ethereum, which are actually one of the easiest ways to get data off of the blockchain. You're seeing new architectures be explored, you know, in the Ethereum space, where you actually just use the blocks as kind of a data storage layer, and then you actually do some of the application you know, state and transition logic off chain. And so you're seeing some new blockchain designs where it's really just going down to the bare essentials of, you know, a bundle of transactions. And then you put as much as possible off chain as you can. And that's kind of in the scalability space. But at its simplest form, it's just a grouping of transactions.
Interesting. Now tell us, where do you think things are headed? You know, what happens after blockchain, or is blockchain just continue?
Well, if I've learned anything, it's not to make predictions in this space. I think you'll live long enough to see your predictions, you know, be proven wrong. But if I were to, you know, gun to the head, I would say, if looking back at what surprised us about DeFi in retrospect, is not that surprising. And the reason for that is DeFi occupies this nice sweet spot in the trade-off space where you can where you can, as a user, you can get a lot of value out of the system for a very small amount of transactions. And what I mean by that is, like, I can go to Uniswap today and I could, you know, transact $1 million worth of, you know, tokens in a single transaction. And so my ratio of, you know, value as a user to number of transactions is actually very high. And so in the early days, you know, of Ethereum, people were kind of pointing to just this transactions per second as sort of the, you know, the God metric that we just need to watch. And until we can do the TPS of, you know, Facebook, we're not going to have any, you know, we're not going to have product market fit for decentralized apps. And what it actually is, it's more of a curve, you know, where there's a lot of different types of applications and they sit at different spots on this ratio of user value to number of transactions. So I think DeFi was kind of the first part of that curve, but you could see, you know, other things like TCRs, where again, you're just sort of voting occasionally, but the list, you know, provides continuous value. You could see gaming be the next version of that. And as these scalability solutions mature, so, you know, in Ethereum, you have things like, you know, state channels, you have things like optimistic rollup. You're going to see more and more apps that are further along that curve where maybe that ratio is a little lower, become viable. And I think just every little bit of scalability improvement that we get is going to unlock a different part of that curve.
And how do we learn more about the graph?
Best way is to go to thegraph.com, check out our blog, and check out our Twitter, which is also just the Graph Protocol.
Thank you so much for sharing your story on the Bitcoin.com podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You've listened to another episode of the Bitcoin.com podcast. Subscribe at news.bitcoin.com, where your journey begins.